This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast for Wednesday, August the 12th. Thank you so much for tuning in today. So much for tuning in today. This is the podcast. This is week two with the brand new microphone, and hopefully I've dialed in a couple of things and it sounds okay. I actually got some feedback last week from the episode, and people said that it actually sounded really, really good. So it's tough to tell because I wear my monitoring headphones, and to me it sounds like it could be a little choppy. Maybe it could be a little bit better, but I will dial it in. Something, it was interesting on the last the microphone that I was using for the previous 3 years. I had all of the, like the acoustics all dialed in to exactly the specifications of that microphone. And it took me a while to kind of get it in, make sure the bass was right, make sure the tone was okay. So this is a completely different microphone. So I'm sort of at square one on that. But it brings me really back to all my programming and production days when I worked at the ESPN affiliate in Seattle. And that was now 13 years ago, 12 years ago, something like that. So as always, I want to make sure that I started with thanking the patrons of the podcast. So patreon.com/ the Mind and Fitness Podcast. There's actually a new patron that has joined us, and that is Kelly. So a really big shout out to Kelly. Joined on at 2:54 this morning as I record this, 2:54 a.m. So big shout out to Kelly. And let me give a big shout out to Tony and Francisco and Ashley, Michael, Mike, Charlie, Todd, Tara, Serena, Victoria, Chad, Anthony, Jennifer, Eddie, Jenny, Sean, Christina, Molly, Ross, Caroline, Julie, Casey, Alyssa, Brian, Sarah, Adrian, Stan, Kristen, Sarah, Helen, Arnie, Barb, and Kim. It is crazy. That's like 25 patrons, something like that. So these are people that get enough value out of this podcast where they feel like they want to contribute an amount. So I urge you, this is a labor of love. There's 130 some odd episodes now, and basically it's throwing some bucks in the tip jar and saying, hey, I appreciate what it is that you're doing. And on that note, I actually got contacted by a potential new sponsor last week, and I got the email that it looks like they're confirmed. And so I think that they're going to be sponsoring. It looks like the agreement was set for 4 episodes, and it's starting next week. And I'm excited to talk about it and give a little bit of a rundown of what it is. And to me, I think that it's timely, because if you've asked for David Hanscom, Dr. Hanscom's COVID guide, there's an element in there and something that he talked about on our podcast together that is a component of this particular thing that is sponsoring the podcast. So that's all that I'll give away. And hopefully we'll have all the T's crossed and I's dotted, and I can talk about it in more detail next week. So I'm excited to be back with an interview, though. It feels like it's been forever, even though it's really only been a couple of weeks. But so Kitty Pert is she's a listener over on the other side of the pond, over in the United Kingdom. And we've been following each other on Instagram for a long time. I've been aware of her. I've seen her contribute in some of the TMS Facebook groups and such. She has a really powerful story. And I got this email. This was back in May. And the subject line just says, TMS healing story, pelvic pain, IC, fibro, endometriosis, anxiety. And we kind of went back and forth and then finally recorded this. And we recorded this, I think it was almost 2 months ago now at this point. So I'm excited for you to kind of get a chance to hear her whole story. It's very long and there's a lot within the email. And we tried to abbreviate it a little bit, because what I was more interested in is what sorts of things is she doing now to be able to keep this kind of stuff at bay and her continued development in this world. And it's really amazing. And you know, huge shout out to Nicole Sachs. As you know, there's a big contributing piece that as we go through it in this, and the real importance of doing expressive writing in that regard. So, Kitty, thank you so much. If you're listening to this, thank you so much for being a part of the podcast. And as always, I thank you. So go to patreon.com/ the Mind and Fitness Podcast. If you don't feel like contributing a monetary amount, an iTunes review is always the absolute best thing you can do. So going over, clicking 5 stars, and then actually writing out a review really does the podcast wonders to be able to help its reach across the world. So thank you so much again. I'm so appreciative and so grateful for all of you that spend every single Wednesday with me. So here is Kitty Pert.
This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein, and we're going to take a jump over the pond today. We're going to interview somebody out in the United Kingdom, out in Brighton, actually. An avid listener of the podcast, which thank you so much, first of all. But there's a lot of really great storytelling that's going to happen over the next 40 or 45 minutes. Kitty Pert is on the line with me. Kitty, are you there?
Hey, I'm here.
So you and I have had some conversations over social media over the last little while, and then you sent me a email that had a whole litany of things that you've kind of gone through. I mean, from the most minor to the most severe, there's some pretty intense surgeries and stories and different things like that. But I thought that it'd be really cool, actually, because, you know, you've kind of got this really full life now at this point, whereas I'm sure, and we'll get into more detail, that it seemed very small at first. Tell us what's going on in your life right now, like, you know, all the things that you do and, you know, kind of just give us the breakdown of you in a nutshell now.
Well, I think the biggest difference now is that I don't associate myself as a sick person and I don't live in the barriers that confined me to. And what I mean by that is I work full time. I have a very loving and great relationship. I can go, you know, Corona aside, I can go out when I want to. I eat what I want to. You know, I don't have to always second guess everything I'm doing anymore. I don't associate myself by any of the diagnosis that I've received in the past, and I don't follow any advice from Dr. Google anymore, which is really important.
The world's worst doctor, Dr. Google.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I think I, you know, last year I went into such a spiral of Dr. Google. And even when it gave me the worst possible outcome, I would search on to the next thing and the next thing. So yeah, very much stayed away from that. But I guess, I live just like a normal, and I put that in inverted commas because what really is normal, but a normal person just living my life. I've just turned 30, so I'm just enjoying that.
Awesome. And I'm curious, like people that knew you or were friends with you or family members or whatever that kind of knew you were going through a lot of this stuff, is it a conversation that ever comes up today at all? I mean, is it ever like, wow, Kitty, what happened with all those things you were going through? Or is it just not even a topic of conversation?
It comes up a lot. So one of my brothers likes to joke that during the surgery that led to the TMS work, I got a full personality transplant during the surgery because the difference in that person who I was and the person who I am now is so severe. I mean, back then I was so anxiety ridden. I was on so much painkiller medication. I was a complete stick in the mud, kind of anti-fun, because I was worried about my pain levels. And now I am so chilled out to the point where I'm nearly horizontal. And I'm much more willing to go with the flow. But it's quite funny you say that because and I'll talk about it later, but yesterday when I was preparing for this podcast, you know, because I've still got some of the TMS personality traits and I wanted to do my best for the podcast interview, making some notes, I came across a daily journal I used to keep when I was not very well. And in the journal, it had three columns for morning, afternoon and night. And I would absolutely track everything from how I slept, my mental state, my symptoms, what I've eaten, you know, just to such a ridiculous degree. And I was so trying to control everything. And I was looking at this just stunned yesterday, just thinking, gosh, I can't even recognize that person I was anymore. And neither can the people around me, thankfully, for the better. But it's wild.
It's interesting that you say that, because I was going through and was just cleaning out my phone, just trying to make some more space not too long ago. And I came across these notes that I had written. These were from very early 2017, where I would keep a daily pain log, I would say. And it would basically just be better, worse. You know, I'd be like, better or worse? What did I do that day? All this kind of stuff. And it was down to the day. And I had kept this thing for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. But it's interesting how I feel like a lot of us in this community kind of think that our stories are so unique, but in a lot of ways, a lot of them are pretty similar.
Yeah. Yeah. This thing was just so intense. I mean, and then I remember I would take all of the daily totals. So, you know, how much sleep I had, if I'd taken tablets, mental state, all of this. And then I would put it into a computer spreadsheet with totals, and I would compare with any treatments I was trying. So I tried out women's physiotherapy at one point, and I was trying out acupuncture, and then I would color code it and give it another score out of 10, which, you know, anyone now will just think that, you know, that might resonate with them, and it might be something they're doing. And one of the biggest things I'm not doing anymore is I don't clock watch, I don't keep tabs on anything, I don't rate anything out of 10. If I get any kind of sensation now, I just kind of go, huh, that's weird. Yeah. And that's as far as I think about it. Yeah, the difference is really so interesting now.
If you could, this is really putting you on the spot. I should have given you a heads up. I was going to ask this, but it just came to me. So if you were to, like, I guess describe yourself now, because you had mentioned earlier that the person that you are now is so drastically different from the person that you were. And I want to talk about the person that you were here in the next little while. But if you were to, you know, say that you're, I don't know, writing an autobiography or describing yourself or whatever, just a sentence or two, how would you describe you as a person now?
I think I am very chilled out to a fault sometimes. Sometimes I need to be a bit more stressed out, but that's the way I roll now. I'm very, you know, I don't like confrontation, so I'm very gentle and easygoing, and I'm just all up for having fun and making memories and laughing now.
I love it. Cool. Okay. Now we're going to hit the rewind button. So we've kind of done where you're at now for, you know, 6 or 7 minutes, and take us back. Give us the year, approximate age when this stuff started getting really bad, and what happened? What was it?
Okay. So it was 2019 when I had an acute TMS episode and I found out about TMS and I did the work, but I've actually kind of tracked it back when I was healing during my, when I was doing the work, and I realized that my whole life I've had a series of TMS symptoms and I've been acting in that TMS personality type. So my home life when I was a kid was very volatile. My mum and dad drank and they really didn't get on very well. And my brother who I lived with, I had three brothers and I lived with one of them. We didn't just fight like siblings. There was real issues there. For whatever reason, we both had really big problems with the other one. So it was quite extreme at home. And weirdly, and I only mention this because my TMS stuff really comes out as pelvic pain or bladder things. When I was really little, I was obsessed with going to the toilet as a kid. You know, I just, wherever we went in public, to a restaurant, I just wanted to go to every single toilet because I felt really safe in the toilet. And I know that sounds completely nutty, but it will make sense later.
Okay.
I developed quite early in my peer group. So I was quite ashamed of my body because it looked very different to the other girls in my year. And I got a lot of unwelcome attention because of that. So that also added to this sense of shame. And because of what was going on at home, I had bad eating habits. It was just how I found comfort because my mum and dad split up. My mum had to then work really long hours, so she wasn't around very much, and so I just binged on junk food, and so I started getting a bit chubby, and I was bullied at home and by other people for being fat, and I wasn't really that fat, but people are mean. So I was really unhappy, and I was an anxious young teenager, and I developed chronic tonsillitis when I was 14, and this kind of cyclical period of illness where I would be very unwell, go to the doctors, get antibiotics, it would be okay. I actually found out I was allergic to penicillin on Christmas Eve because I was so unwell. They gave me penicillin and I had a hideous allergic reaction, and it eventually led to my tonsils coming out, and I think other things cropped up. migraines, headaches, and it just kind of went through various minor ailments, but nothing seemed related. And of course, we grew up in the Western medical model anyway, so we just went to the doctor, did what the doctor said, and got on with things.
Yep.
And then when I was 19, in 2009, that's when the bladder stuff for me kicked off. So 2009 was a really dreadful year for me personally. Anyway, my eldest brother took his own life, and I was in a really damaging relationship at the time, made worse by the fact that 6 weeks after my brother passed away, this person said, well, why aren't you over it yet? And then I started to really question, you know, my grief, and maybe I'm feeling too much, and I've always been called too sensitive. That was one of the things that my people at home used to say, oh, you're just too sensitive. And I was a sensitive kid. But anyway, so I then developed a UTI the same year, and I went to the doctors just like everyone did, but I was really ashamed of my body. I hated having any kind of exams. And I got the antibiotics. They didn't work. And I had all the usual UTI symptoms that people are familiar with. And eventually I went back to the doctors, took another round of antibiotics. They didn't work. And it developed into this kidney infection, and I had to go to accident and emergency for it. And I remember being quite belittled by the nurse that saw me as well. She didn't believe how ill I was, did the tests, then realized. And so I was just kind of being made to feel small all the time.
Yeah.
But these symptoms just didn't go away. And the symptoms that stayed with me was this acute urethral burning pain. And I was really ashamed to talk about it. I didn't like talking about it with my mum. I was frightened of my own body. And eventually we had to go to the urologist, who I found really intimidating. He was a middle-aged guy. He didn't seem very compassionate. It was very scary. And he said he was going to have to do a flexible cystoscopy, which is where they put a camera into your bladder whilst I was awake, which for anyone sounds awful. But for a 19-year-old girl who hates getting naked, that was the worst thing that could possibly have happened. But I was so desperate. You know, I couldn't attend my college course that I was going to, and I was really losing my friends because I couldn't see them. So I went along, and I had this procedure. And I don't want to get too much into the nitty-gritty, but basically they're supposed to numb you before they put the camera in, and this guy didn't wait till the nummy stuff worked. Put the camera in, was really having a good old look around, and I was begging for him to stop. I was screaming and crying, and I had three nurses holding down my shoulders, basically telling me I was making a fuss. And when they eventually stopped the procedure, because I was just causing so much aggro for them, one of the nurses wheeled me to a bathroom, just told me to clean myself up, and left me to it. So now I felt really terribly ashamed of how I'd behaved as well. Like, I was wasting everyone's time. I was in a lot of pain. The doctors weren't listening. So obviously this is just my fault.
Right.
And I remember the urologist came round to my mum and I afterwards and just said, well, she's got ulcers in her bladder, but we couldn't biopsy them. She was causing too much of a fuss. So we're going to have her in for another procedure. And I just looked at my mum and said, I'm not doing that again. I'm just going to live with this, you know, stuff this. He's not coming anywhere near me. And so I did. And I guess I applied TMS principles without realizing, because I just, you know, I hadn't heard of interstitial cystitis at this point. I didn't Google anything. I just thought, well, I'm going to carry on with my life. So I finished college from home. I moved out when I was 21, and things were pretty good. My urethral pain became less and less, to the point that it was just, you know, a slight annoyance, and then eventually it went. But it was okay. I got some migraines, so I started to be prescribed high dose levels of codeine, and that was fine. I just adapted to that. And then kind of 2010, 2014, I was working in a really highly stressful environment. I was working 40-hour weeks with a two-hour commute, with a boss that was basically a bully. And made everyone around her feel awful.
Hopefully she, hopefully she's not listening right now.
Oh, yeah, hopefully she is and she feels bad. But yeah, she was terrible. And then I started having endometriosis symptoms. So, you know, that's a disease of the that can affect all your pelvic muscles and is often cyclical with your periods, but generally causes immense pain and heavy bleeding and that sort of thing. But because my symptoms, when I did go on Dr. Google for this, kept coming up as ovarian cancer symptoms, my mum said, no, we're going to send you to a consultant because, you know, we're very lucky to have the NHS in the UK, but it does mean that waiting times are really long. So I was able to go to a private consultant who performed my first laparoscopy, one of 7 or 8 surgeries I've had now, I can't remember anymore, who diagnosed me with endometriosis stage 4, which is the worst stage, suspected adenomyosis, which is a very similar disease, but it affects the lining of your womb, vaginismus, which is often related to a trauma event, but not always, where the muscles in your vagina basically contract and it can make anything very painful.
To be clear on the trauma or event thing, since this is such a, there's so much commingling of emotional events with physical sensations, when you say trauma or event, you're saying something physical, right?
Something physical, okay. Yeah. So one of the things I had to come to terms with in my TMS healing journey was that I had a number of traumatic sexual experiences with an ex in my past that I hadn't really admitted to myself what they were. So my body was just reacting in such a way as if to just not let anyone come near me anymore. She also diagnosed me with vulvodynia, so that's kind of vaginal pain on the outside, but it can be on the inside as well. I mean, I got a crib sheet of diagnosis from this one operation that was as long as my arm. And whilst I was under, she also performed a bladder distension. So even though my bladder was absolutely fine at this point, because I told her my medical history, she said, oh, we should have a look at your bladder. So a bladder distension is where they fill up your bladder with water. And I think it's usually done when you're under general anesthetic. Certainly mine was. And it's kind of filled up so much that it's past the point of that you could bear it. And then it's stretched a bit and then it's the water's let out. And when I came to, she said, yep, you've got interstitial cystitis. It's really quite bad. And she kept mentioning these ulcers as well. And to treat all of this, I think I had some vaginal Botox injections to calm the muscles down. And she wanted me to take amitriptyline, but there was just something in my head saying, no, I don't want to take that kind of stuff. And she was offering me all this hormone medication and I didn't take it. And I just kind of got on with things. So then during that period, I must have had about 4 more laparoscopies and they just try and cut away the endometriosis as much as possible. And I just very quickly got used to a very medicalized lifestyle. So by now I was taking 230 milligrams of codeine every day, dealing with pain, working full time, having surgeries pretty much every year, and just being defined by the diagnoses that these people had given me. And what was also something I noticed I did was all of the people in my past that perhaps I had seen as being quite mean to me, I was then able to say, well, actually, I'm a sick person. You know, I've got 5 diagnoses or whatever it was. And I became very quickly defined by those words that the doctors had given me as well. As well as this, I had really bad sciatica that my endo consultant put down to the fact that I've got endometriosis on my bowel and my bowel is fused to my uterus. I also had severe back pain that, again, he just put down to the endometriosis. And, you know, life was pretty rough, but I was trying to get by as best I could. And then I decided around 2014 I was going to move back in with my mum and start a university degree. And everyone who I told completely laughed at that idea because, you know, I wasn't the brightest spark at school. So then I felt like I had something that I really needed to prove. And I put an enormous amount of pressure on myself. Only A grades would do. And I think in 3 years, every single assignment I had, only one wasn't an A grade. And to this day, that still stings me a bit.
What were you going to pursue a degree in?
I did my degree in Museum and Heritage Studies.
Okay.
And it was good because I thought I'd really like to work in a museum and be a curator or something like that. And then whilst I was at university, I was still having surgeries. I developed really bad acne as well, which looking back, I can just see how all these things are TMS. But I went to a dermatologist and he kind of laughed and said, you know, your acne is so severe, we'd consider it a disfigurement. So he put me on Accutane, but he put me on a low dose, but for a long time. And I know Accutane is a really controversial drug in the States as well, as it is here. And it can lead to a lot of mental health problems. And I, you know, all my joints hurt because of the way the medicine works. That wasn't really very helpful. And I was eventually diagnosed with fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome as well, on top of these. So I was just kind of getting this litany of diagnosis and trying to be a 20-year-old whilst putting immense pressure on myself to do well at my degree. And I did my degree. I got a first and I felt nothing. I didn't feel like I'd accomplished anything. I just thought, oh, okay, what's next then? And so I made myself do a master's and I was getting more and more unwell. My symptoms were getting worse. And you know, it was wild. I eventually developed a bone tumor in my pelvis and I had that removed. And I just remember thinking, I'll give myself 2 weeks off, but then I've got to get back and I've got to get back to my dissertation and do really well in that. And my priorities were so all wrong. Anyway, so eventually we're led to last year, but that kind of gives you a glimpse into what my personality type was like. And how I was reacting to situations. I was just running on fear, I think, for my whole life. And being so medicalized for such a long time made that worse and just kind of grounded that fear for me.
Had you ever, you know, when all this stuff is going on, because we're talking about basically 10 years of a lot of this stuff, had you been exposed to or seen a therapist or a psychotherapist or like, was that even a part of your, and not for this stuff, not because, and we're going to get to how you would come across Nicole Sachs's work and Dr. Sarno's work and things like that. But even just for all the stuff that had happened in your life leading up to that point, had you considered going to see a therapist or had you seen one?
Yeah, so I'd considered it, and I think initially I'd started with seeing a counselor because, and I don't know if that's a distinction you have in America, a counselor is someone that doesn't necessarily have the degree, and so they're not as expensive. I didn't find her terribly helpful, but then as I started doing my degree, my mental health just got to a point I was so anxious that I saw a proper psychologist. And she was helpful, but obviously not enough for my brain at the time. And I was diagnosed as having an anxiety disorder. So, you know, it was quite bad. But I later found a much better therapist who could help me. But yeah, I tried it, but I didn't find the right one.
And so that's something interesting that I'm going to I'll have to remember to come back to that. Because one thing that I'm curious about, but I feel like it's a few minutes away, is being diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. There are some doctors that believe that's totally separate of TMS. And then there are some doctors that believe that it would be cured exactly the same way that you would cure a bad back or endometriosis or any of this other stuff. How did you get turned on to Dr. you know, Dr. Sarno's work or Nicole Sachs' work, or because it's such a radical change from all the things that you went through and did and Western medicine and all that kind of stuff to, hey, I can journal or I can read this book or yeah. I can meditate or whatever. How did you get there?
So last year in March, I had either my 7th or 8th surgery, can't remember how many I've had. And it was a really extensive surgery for endometriosis. And my consultant at the time had already put the fear of God into me by saying, your recovery is going to be really awful. This is going to be really hard on your body. And also that he was going to do work on my bladder, even though my bladder had been fine for a good number of years. So I was going into this operation with a mountain of fear. And I was really, you know, I was chronically fatigued just from having so many surgeries and not having the time to recover from them properly. And I was just getting really fed up. But anyway, I had the surgery. I had an allergic reaction to morphine in hospital, which meant that I could no longer take the codeine that I'd been dependent on for 10 years. And they couldn't find another painkiller that would work with me. So I was recovering from this surgery with no painkillers. And a week after the surgery, sure enough, I got what I perceived to be a UTI. Took me right back to when I was 19, urethral burning, kind of burning pain in my legs, nausea, stomach cramping, frequency, urgency, all of it. It all came back. And so I rang up the doctors, terrified. I think I was just not even a week post-op. They prescribed some antibiotics over the telephone, took them, didn't go away, took some more. And the whole time I'm just getting more and more freaked out. I'm Googling, I'm trying to figure out what's going on. I had a meeting with my new consultant because my consultant who did the surgery retired the day after, who said that, oh, I think this is just an immunological response. I'm not really sure why your body's doing this. And what my original consultant told me he was going to do during the surgery did not match the operation notes and did not match with what this other consultant was saying. So to this day, I literally no idea what they did during this surgery. I couldn't tell you. So as well as having these UTI symptoms, I also started getting this weird genital buzzing is the only way I could describe it. It was just uncomfortable. I was hyper aware of it. I was getting weird pullings on my right side of my hip, tinges of pain kind of throughout my undercarriage, and I was constantly aware of how I felt, and the more aware of it I was, the more attention I was giving it, and I was checking in constantly on how it felt. I was going back and forth to my GP because I couldn't actually sleep after the operation and my anxiety exploded. And I've now come to understand that I was going through a massive opiate withdrawal, but none of my doctors actually put that one together.
Yeah.
I went to the doctor, I told him I couldn't sleep. I was only sleeping about 3 hours a night for weeks and weeks. And so they countered that by giving me benzodiazepines, beta blockers for anxiety, and sleeping tablets, which didn't actually work. So I still wasn't sleeping. And I started really getting a big distrust for the doctors then. I was going to accident and emergency in the UK for my bladder. No one could help me. No one could tell me what was going on. My GP just kind of dismissed me. And at one point I told him I'd lost a lot of weight and I was suicidal. And he just kind of went, take the benzodiazepines. That will calm you down. You know, it really felt like he didn't care. And I went up to Harley Street in London, which is where a lot of our specialist private practitioners are based, to see quite a famous interstitial cystitis professor who treats with long-term use of antibiotics. I told him exactly what was going on. He tested my urine, and he does it in a slightly different way than conventional doctors do. He's looking for an embedded urinary infection in the bladder. And even though my results didn't really come out as saying very much, he still said, well, I think we should treat you with long-term antibiotics. So I did his treatment protocol for a few weeks. I wasn't getting any better. like I said at the beginning, I was keeping a daily journal that was tracking things like symptoms, sleep, tablets, mental state, what I ate, how my body responded to what I'd eaten, activity level, pain, which I scaled out of 10. And I'd constantly look back on this book and I'd check day to day, you know, what was making me feel better. And so I was just getting more and more immersed into this fear bubble. And I started getting this genital buzzing that I had started turning into immense pain. Vulvodynia basically feels like you've got a sunburnt vagina. And I'm sorry to be so literal, but
that's okay.
That's what it felt like. And I couldn't actually sit down anymore. I could only stand up or lay down because sitting or any kind of pressure was so uncomfortable. I actually had to buy quite a number of those donut pillows that I think people use for hemorrhoids and pregnant ladies get, just to see if I could sit down, and I couldn't. So I was very, very quickly turning into the shell of a person. I was in so much pain. I had no pain relief. I was trying this long-term antibiotic protocol from this doctor, and I just noticed that this vulvodynia pain was getting so intense, and I looked at the side effects of these tablets, and it said genital pain. So I ripped up that prescription. I'd never spoken to that man again. He doesn't know why I stopped his treatment protocol, but I've just decided, you know, that's not right for me. I put myself on the IC diet, the interstitial cystitis diet. And for anyone that's not aware of what that is, it is really restrictive. You know, you've got to pretty much eat very plain food, a lot of vegetables. But through going on the IC diet and where my personality was at that time, I developed an eating disorder and I lost 2 stone very, very quickly. And I spoke to someone last week or the week before. They said I actually looked skeletal at one point. And I was just frantically running on no sleep. I was Googling things. I was trying things out. I went to women's pelvic physiotherapist. I tried out all of the different kind of feminine creams going, including ordering one from Italy that was really expensive, and they all made me worse. I was too scared to have a shower. Too scared to have a bath, only showers. I was too scared to wash my hair in the shower in case any of the shampoo went on my vagina and made it worse. You know, my brain started just living in my pelvis. And I was so hyper aware of any contact that I had with it. And I went to a consultant again because I just thought, no, someone's got to be able to tell me what's wrong. And this consultant was so dismissive, and she was kind of the fifth consultant I'd seen who said, you know, I really think you should just try amitriptyline. This will make you feel better. And my then fiance at the time really pressured me into trying amitriptyline. He was very fed up of how mad I'd become and just thought, you're being stupid. You need to do what the doctor said. So I went against all my better judgments. I took amitriptyline. And before I say this, I recognize that it does work for some people. So, you know, I'm not putting a downer on that. But it made me feel like my drink had been spiked. And I felt so out of control that I didn't touch the amitriptyline again. And I also went to the sexual health clinic numerous times, and I was almost begging the nurses to tell me I had an STI or something. I was going, you know, can you just check again? Does everything look okay? Because I just wanted someone to tell me what was wrong and to be able to fix it. But eventually I kind of ran out of steam, and I had to just kind of face the maelstrom that I had created in going to see so many different practitioners, tried to limit my diet so much. I was logging everything. I just kind of had to sit there and go, this isn't working, and so I need to find something else because I'm making myself worse. And I just so happened to at that time be on a number of Facebook groups for the different diagnoses I had. And I was on one for vulvodynia, which I absolutely do not recommend anyone with any sort of vaginal pain to go on a vulvodynia forum, because it really takes all of your hope away. But in this instance, this girl from Australia said, hey, I've been trying this work of Nicole Sachs for my pain and it's really helped. And I think I was just in a desperate enough place to try it, even though it wasn't a conventional medicine treatment that I had been following avidly for the 10 years beforehand. So I started looking up Nicole Sachs. I think I started with her YouTube. I think she's got 4 YouTube videos, learning more about it. And somewhere amongst the searing pain I was in daily and the UTI feelings in my bladder, I just thought, you know what, this makes so much more sense than all of the medical interventions I'd had. And as I was learning more about TMS, I had another women's pelvic physio appointment. And the physiotherapist was saying, you know, I think you've got elements of pudendal neuralgia, you've got pelvic floor dysfunction, something else wrong with my muscles. There's elements of PGAD, which is pelvic genital arousal disorder, which isn't strictly what it sounds like. I think she was talking more about this weird buzzing I had in my pelvis. But she started saying that they treat all of these conditions the same, and the first thing they've got to do is calm down the nervous system. And so they require all of their clients to meditate and to do breath work. And because that clicked with what I was learning about TMS and Nicole's work, I never went back to the pelvic physiotherapist, because in my mind that just confirmed everything I was starting to learn about the body and how chronic pain is produced and sustained, and how our nervous system can create chronic create pain and acute pain. So I started doing Nicole's work, but of course I was still one of those people that was defining myself by my symptoms. I was terrified, so I was that person on all of the TMS groups going, I've got this symptom and this symptom and it started, and has anyone got these exact symptoms in this exact order? And I was still very fear-based, and I'm very lucky that in Nicole's group there was Whitney, who you've had on your podcast.
Yeah, Whitney Radman. Yeah.
And another lady called Sarah, who could kind of hold my hand in those initial stages, and they were kind enough to spend a lot of time coaching me down from absolute terror into a place where I could be far more accepting of TMS. And so I did Nicole's 28-day challenge, and within 28 days my vulvodynia genital pain had completely gone.
It is amazing,
and I didn't believe it even though I was pain free and I could actually sit down.
How I'm curious on the 28-day thing, because when she first put that out, I think it feels like it's been a couple of years, which, by the way, yeah. There's for anybody that's listening to this that doesn't know what she's talking about. If you go to YouTube and you type Nicole Sachs, SACHS LCSW, and you look through her YouTube videos, you'll find an explanation of this 28-day challenge. But the premise is that you're journaling for 20 minutes a day for 28 straight days. And it seems very daunting. How did you, in the very beginning, did it seem like this was a daunting task, or did it seem like I can do 20 minutes a day?
I think I was blessed, and I use that word a bit strangely, with the fact that I had become so unwell that I had nothing to fill my days with. So finding half an hour in my day of, 20 minutes journal speak with 10 minutes meditation that Nicole advocates for was quite easy. And so I almost did an intense TMS phase in my life where I did my journal and meditation in the morning, followed by listening to some podcasts, followed by reading some books. And at first I was having so many emotional epiphanies left, right, and center, because I'd never actually thought about anything in such a way before. And there was obviously the upset, and there was a lot of feelings of shame around the medical procedures I had, which stem back from, feeling ashamed of my body, because lucky me, all of my medical procedures, I've had to show my naked body to, I think, half of the UK by now. You know, so many people in these operating rooms.
Yeah.
And for me, that was just the worst thing ever. So I was dealing with these feelings of shame. But the 28 days only seemed daunting at the time because I was clock watching the 28 days. So I, you know, initially it felt like such a big mountain to climb. And also I was still a little bit in disbelief. I didn't really know how it was going to help. And one of the questions that came from my VHive interview was, did your pain just switch off overnight? And it didn't just switch off overnight. I just gradually noticed it less and less. And I wasn't checking in with it so much because I think the meditation and just finding a community where I felt heard and supported for the first time probably in my life allowed me to relax so much more. And I'd previous to this work, I'd always describe myself as someone that I just don't know how to relax. My body just doesn't know how to do it. And it still fights me when I'm trying to do meditation or whatever, but I'm certainly able to relax and I make myself relax a lot more.
I think I know what you're going to say and sort of how you're going to describe it, but tell people how, you know, a forced relaxation seems like an oxymoron, but I think I know what you mean. Can you explain, you know, it's tough for you to relax. What do you do to chill? Like, how do you relax your body?
Well, even now, so even as we're talking now, I can feel myself doing it, but I never realized I used to do this. I naturally clench my leg muscles, my stomach muscles, my pelvic muscles, and my bum muscles. And I've been doing that my whole life since I was a child. And I've come to realize through working with a different therapist, that is a protection method that kids that have experienced a lot of trauma will often have. And this was obviously leading to my pain. So what meditation allowed me to do, so rather I did the journal speak for 20 minutes and I'd rage on the page and I'd get it all out. And then I'd sit, put my headphones in. I don't actually like meditating sitting up or in a chair. I don't find I can relax like that. So I'll lie down. I'll quite often get a blanket so I'm nice and warm. And the way I meditate is I do breathing exercises. I do box breathing for a few rounds while the meditation's going. And then I have to go through my whole body and unclench all my muscles that are naturally clenching. And more often than not, I'll unclench them. And even this day, they'll be clenched right back up again as soon as I forget it. So I'm still training my brain. But forced relaxation for me is just defining a space in which I have to actively relax my body. And once I've relaxed my body, my mind will follow and it will feel so much lighter afterwards.
And there's something I want to underscore for people that are listening to something that you had just said is training your brain. The whole concept of TMS stuff, whether it's anxiety or whether it's some kind of a body pain or whether it's an internal pain or whatever the case is like it's a neural pathway. So you'd said that all that different clenching in those different parts of the body are going to be common or typical for people that have had a lot of trauma, particularly early on in life. And so that is a neural response. It's a stress response, is that you're going to be constantly clenching. So think about how long it is to unlearn a habit that you've been doing for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, maybe even longer. That's why at 10 minutes a day, when people sometimes will read the Sarno book and they'll try this stuff for, you know, a week or a couple of weeks and they don't see all the results or even massive results and they kind of give up or say, this is all bullshit. Like, you have to be able to unlearn all that. So what you're doing at a clip of 10 minutes per day is trying to unclench. I do the exact same thing. In fact, one of the things that I've been thinking about lately when it comes to the neuroscience side of this is that the places where I was having a lot of the spasms initially were the places that I was clenching during physical therapy recovering from a shoulder surgery. And so if I'm constantly intentionally clenching these particular muscles, suddenly like my nervous system just assumes, oh, this is the norm. We need to be clenching all the time. So yeah. I do the exact same thing as you. It's right when I'm in bed, I do breathing exercises and I intentionally unclench every single part of my body that I can sense is clenched. And it seems kind of daunting, but it's actually the more that you do it, meaning like let's say it's your unclenching your shoulder, then unclenching your biceps, then unclench it. Like you can go body part by body part, almost like you're building a little farm on your body. Is sort of how I see it. It becomes very relaxing.
Yeah, it does. And sometimes I even find now if I start doing the box breathing or I start doing a little bit of unclenching, all of my body sometimes will just relax all at once without me having to try very hard. What was quite interesting is I was doing a meditation the other day and the lady who was speaking was saying, now focus on your face and relax your eyebrows and relax your lip muscles. And I didn't realize that I actually clenched my face somehow as well. But yeah, just my whole body, I think, quite often in a state of protection and ready to protect myself. And it's been a long time teaching it that actually I'm okay and the people I'm around are safe. And we don't need to do this anymore. But it's still my go-to. If I start feeling stressed or if there's even a confrontation that's near me but that I'm not involved in, I'll notice that all of my body clenches up just going, oh, no, protect yourself.
Yep.
So I think I'm going to be doing that for a long time in the foreseeable, just keep on relaxing. And I guess the more I do it, the more it will be short-wired. And it would just come easier and easier.
Well, and one of the things that it makes me think of is like, I don't know, let's say that what's a good example? Let's say that you're playing a sport, or like for anybody out here, I get a lot of people that message me and say that, you know, I was an athlete, I was a football player, I was this, I was that. And if you think about the bracing before contact, if you can anticipate something coming to you, whether it's your kid is tackling you or what, I mean, there could be a lot of different examples, or you're seeing a car heading towards you, you're clenching and bowing up because you have a perceived threat. And those are very physical threats that are coming at you. But it's the exact same. The brain doesn't know the difference between a physical threat, an emotional threat, a mental threat. And so all this really is that we're talking about is clenching because of a perceived emotional threat. And things that were not reconciled that were 20 years ago. And so that's a lot of the stuff that you're describing.
Yeah.
So I want to get to the last couple of minutes here. I'm just curious on, because you did the 28-day challenge in 2019, right?
Yeah.
What is, if you have one, sort of a regular regimen now at this point? Do you have anything aside from doing the breathing and the meditation that, you know, the unclenching, the conscious unclenching? Is there anything else that you do with fair regularity at this point?
Well, I did the 28-day challenge, and around the same time, I also started to see a trauma-based cognitive behavioral therapist. And I told her that I had found this thing called TMS and I wanted to work within a structure that kind of went along with TMS principles. And she was really actually open and willing to do that. So if anyone wants a good therapist in Brighton, then I'm happy to pass along her details.
Cool.
But before I could really, you know, my vulvodynia pain subsided substantially, but before I could really proceed much further, I had to address some really big trauma memories. You know, there was a lot of sexual trauma there and feelings of shame. I was also, when I was 12, I was robbed at gunpoint as well, which was a memory that I hadn't processed at all. So it's all of these memories where I felt like people were doing things to me. So I worked with my CBT therapist and I saw her regularly for a long time. I was seeing her once a week. And I also did Nicole's course, which I found I got a lot of benefit from. But for anyone who's worried about paying for the course, I don't feel like it's necessary because she gives so much great information through her podcast and YouTube and her book as well.
Awesome.
But I just had to do the practice really regularly. I just had to commit to doing it in the morning, because if I didn't do it in the morning, then I wasn't going to do it. I found myself getting really resentful of the idea of doing it if I left it till later in the day. And I know what Sano said was kind of resistance to the work can be part of TMS itself. And I definitely have that. My brain doesn't want to play if it's not done first thing. So I did the course. I committed to it in the morning, and I was getting better and better to the point that I actually went back to full-time work, and I was due to get married in this February, but I broke up with my fiance of 10 years because through the journaling, I realized that that relationship really wasn't good for me. And I was just committed to making myself the best version of myself I could be. So, I mean, other things that I did, and I made a little list, so I'm sorry if this sounds a bit scripted, but I really stopped associating with the sick person identity I'd created myself. And I stopped using the excuse of being as well unwell as not to do things. So I wouldn't say if I was having a symptomatic day that I couldn't do something. I'd always go and try it. I got off disability completely. So that was a safety net that was taken away from me. I removed myself from any specific illness group on Facebook or any of the other communities. And I also removed myself from any TMS group that dwelled on symptoms and described anything in that way, because I found that to be really unhelpful while I was trying to heal and do the emotional work when people were fixating on symptoms. And I also stopped referring to my symptoms under the disease and condition labels, if that makes sense. I stopped saying I had interstitial cystitis.
Yeah.
And if anyone asked, I'd just say, oh, I had something going on with my bladder, but it was a mind-body thing.
It's interesting you say the thing about the symptoms, because I don't want to glaze over that. My buddy Brad and I run a TMS group that has about 3,000 members, and we put in a very strict policy about a year or so ago that we're not talking yeah. symptoms, and people get crazily pissed at us because we try and turn that stuff off, and they'll say, oh, this is you're being bullies, and you're not you're not letting us talk about these things, and it's supposed to be a support group. And I mean, I was a part of support groups for people with neuromuscular disease for years, and it's just a very different type of a support group has a very different connotation than what it is that we're trying to help people do. And I mean, Dr. Hanscom won't even really talk to anybody until they've made 12 weeks of making better sleep, journaling, and not talking about symptoms. Not a lot of people would be able to commit to that.
Yeah. I think one of the things I found a really hard lesson in the beginning, but now I agree with it so much, is I was on these sites and I was in the groups going, oh, I've got vulvodynia and bladder stuff and it's happened like this, and does anyone experience like this? And I wanted someone to have my exact symptom range completely, but actually it doesn't matter. And it's very scary feeling like you're on your own in your symptoms, but the reality is you're not. But if you keep playing the symptoms and you keep giving them energy, they're only going to stick around longer.
Yep.
And I was actually a member of yours and Brad's group. I don't really go on any of the groups anymore. And I really appreciated the fact that you said, let's not talk about symptoms anymore, because it was refreshing. And it enables everyone to see that actually what we're all dealing with, regardless of how our symptoms are presenting, is emotional work that we have got to work through.
Yep.
And so it makes you feel much more together, regardless if you're presenting with back pain or migraines or foot pain or whatever. But I also asked people closest to me to stop asking how I was feeling. So the poor people around me thought I had lost my mind because I had gone from 10 years of being operated on and medicalized and taking painkillers to all of a sudden I was journaling and meditating every day.
Yep.
And getting better. Everyone thought I'd completely lost my shit. And, you know, I think they still do. Some of them still do. But, you know, because they're caring people, they were asking me how I was, how my symptoms were, if I was feeling better, could I do more, what's my energies level like? And I had to be really blunt in the end and said, please stop talking about my symptoms or pain or referring to those times, because, you know, I was starting to feel good. I was starting to have days where my symptoms weren't at the forefront of my mind. And anyone asking me those questions took me right back there, and I would scan my pelvis. I would pinpoint, oh, something feels weird. Is it a buzz? Is it pain? And it was really unhelpful. And so I made it easier for people. And I said, if I'm having a bad day, I'm going to tell you I'm feeling bladdery, because that was a nicer word in my head. And I didn't want anyone to ask me any further than that. So, yeah, they thought I was mad, but they respected that boundary as well, which was good. But I spent a lot of time going through all of the podcasts and hearing testimonials and reading other TMS recovery posts. Like I said, I check in and I unclench all my muscles. I stopped clock watching with the healing. So the 28-day challenge is an interesting one because it sets you on a very time-conscious way of healing. But then you learn that the more you clock watch, the worse or the more prolonged your journey is going to take. And throwing away my journals that I was avidly filling in morning, noon and night, and stopping clock watching and just kind of accepting that this is going to take as long as it takes was a hard lesson, and I didn't want to do it. I had a lot of resistance to it, but actually it was one of the best things I could have done.
And
books. So I read all the usual books. So Nicole Sachs's book, Meaning of Truth, Mind Over Medicine by Dr. Lissa Rankin, Sarno's book. And I really like Steve Ozanich's book, Great Pain Deception, as well, because what's especially helpful is in the back, you know, there's all those TMS equivalents. And I was able to almost just go and look through them and go, yep, had that, that's fine. And he does talk a lot about the bladder stuff as well, so that was really helpful. So now I don't do my TMS practice every day because I don't feel like I need to. I've had a lot of emotional breakthroughs, but I do need to do it at least a couple of times a week, because I never realized I'm such a laid back person.
Yeah.
But I get angry at so much pointless shit, and it's the way that I just have to let it out through my journaling, and then I can calm down and be a reasonable human. I mean, to the outside, everyone just thinks I'm happy about everything, but yeah, in my head I get wound up about really pointless stuff.
I do too. My wife is constantly telling me that why are you wasting so much brain energy on that? And that's usually a sign I need to go rage at somebody on a page, write that letter to somebody that I'm never going to send.
Yeah. So. I did. And when I was listening to your podcast before, I did try and do the writing exercises that you were doing. I'm not sure if you still do them where you just write, I feel.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get on with that for some reason. I don't know what it was, but I have to do the Nicole Sachs method of doing it.
I think the reason that it may not be all that helpful for some people is just simply that TMSers to me are very much storytellers. And if you're walking around all day telling a story and having a fictitious argument in your head with somebody, which I think a lot of us do, you know, we're so wound up about certain situations and they sort of live in our head all the time, that to simplify that and have it be one line of I feel over and over and over and over and over it's not countering the long form arguments that we're having in our head. Whereas if you're writing a long form document like a journal, that would be much more believable, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, Kitty, let's wrap up. I had planned on 40 minutes. We're at 58. So that tells me it was an engaging conversation. I hope a lot of people got a lot out of this. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care.
Bye.